Welcome to Tech It to the Limit, the humorous and surprisingly informative podcast that makes digital innovation in healthcare as entertaining as it is relevant. I'm Sarah Harper.
And I'm Elliot Wilson. And we're here to pull back the curtain on the world of digital transformation in healthcare.
Don't worry, you don't need a medical degree to join in on the fun. Just a sense of humor and a penchant for all things health tech.
So buckle up, folks. It's time to
Tech It to the Limit.
What's up, Elliot?
What's up, Sarah? Oh my gosh, it's episode 3. So excited for this episode.
Yeah, why are you excited? I mean, there couldn't possibly be a good reason.
Happy Pride!
Pride, that's right. The best month of the year.
It is. It's, although normally I get up on my soapbox and I complain about rainbow capitalism and how it's
Target.
It's like, what was that? Yeah, Target. Exactly. Normally I complain about Target. And you know what? They kowtowed so much this year that even the local Target in where I live in southern New Jersey, bastion of liberalism, they didn't even stock their store there for Pride. And I almost missed it. I was nostalgic for my rainbow capitalism.
Right. Rainbow capitalism. That sounds like, you know, actually a really good business proposition. Like you could have like rainbow soft serve, like rainbow unexpected products, right? That are rainbow.
Oh, let me tell you, there's some really unexpected products for Pride.
Yes. Like all of the fashion that Target used to choose to put in the front of their store was like bizarre to me. Same thing for Black History Month. Okay. Can I just get up on my soapbox and say
yes, that please.
Like, it really bothers me that we only talk about disenfranchisement 1 month out of the year for like each subset, whether it's, you know, Women's History Month or Asian Pacific Islander Heritage Month, or okay, this is your month to get, you know, focus on your equity issues. And then we're going to move on to someone else who happens to still be disenfranchised in this country. Really freaking annoying.
Yeah. I mean, like, that's my problem with rainbow capitalism. And you see on LinkedIn, June 1st, all of their automatic settings to turn their logos rainbow color all happen at the same time. And it's just, you know, people are like, I need to work for a company where I can live my true self. And like, they get all excited about being in these employee resource groups and yada, yada, yada. And this is an actuarial decision to have these things to stop you from leaving the organization because it's cheaper to keep you there than managing the turnover. You will be replaced in a week, even if you're gay.
Right. Yeah.
Anyway.
But you know what? You know, on the positive side, What are you and your family doing to celebrate this historic occasion that only comes around once a year and happens to last 30 days?
Well, we always like going out to like Pride festivals nearby. Yeah. There's a number of different Pride festivals nearby, so it's great. My daughters are young, so I want to get them out there and seeing families like theirs. They don't often get a chance to see families like theirs.
Yeah.
Through school and other mechanisms. So that's a really great way to do it. They either happen in usually like in October around National Coming Out Day, or they happen in June for Pride Month. So kind of bookends the spring and fall.
Nice.
What about you? What are you doing, ally, for Pride Month?
What am I doing? I'm continuing to be an ally. I know that sounds like really lazy, but trying to check in with myself and notice my blind spots and see what more I could be doing to help the folks in my community that are in my circle of friends or my neighbors or my family members. And I don't subscribe to rainbow capitalism, so I try not to do like the token post on social and those types of things. I don't know. I'd be interested in being called out on that if it's not an effective disengagement strategy, if that makes sense. But it turns me off, right?
Yeah. Well, right. Because again, it goes back to there's these automatic scheduled posts from corporations and people on places like LinkedIn that were scheduled, written and scheduled 3 months ago to be posted, right? And how real is that sentiment if it's the same kind of mushy sentiment for every single thing that comes up?
And you know what? I think kind of circling back to your question, I don't really celebrate Pride Month per se because I do it every day with my family. Like when we go to the library, you mentioned, and your husband's an author, right, of children's books. Like we look for books that represent all families and all in a diversity of stories, right? And when it's election season, we research the candidates and I bring my kids to the polling place and we talk about, well, why is this such a difficult decision for mommy? Because she's fiscally conservative, but socially liberal. And usually the latter trumps the former on my ballot. So, you know, we try to bring those types of conversations into the fold every day of the year. And maybe I do need to make a point of celebrating Pride Month more openly, no pun intended, with my kids. So thank you for that challenge. I do want to tie this back into Tech It to the Limit. I'm sorry I got us on like a little tangent here.
But there's like another thing that we've done for Pride Month.
Oh, yeah.
That I think is...
That we're super proud of. Yeah. Why don't you go ahead and tell our listeners, Elliot, who are we welcoming today on this episode of the pod?
Yeah, I know it's late in the month for Pride Month, but, and it's also late into his tenure, but we are so excited to bring our listeners an interview with Dr. Jesse Ehrenfeld, the president of the American Medical Association.
Cue fangirl sound effects. So excited. Yeah, Dr. Jesse was so fun to talk to. And we usually have folks on this pod that have really impressive resumes, but this dude like checks all the boxes. Navy veteran, anesthesiologist, husband, father, professor of health policy, and professor of anesthesiology at Vanderbilt. He's a director of a $560 million endowment at the Medical College of Wisconsin, happens to do some consulting on the side for the World Health Organization, and serves as the special advisor to the Surgeon General. And did we mention that he is the first openly gay president of the American Medical Association? Dang.
Do these credentials make my butt look big? What the heck?
They definitely make his pockets look big. Because those business cards can't fit that whole alphabet on it. But we honestly are so honored and quite frankly tickled pink that he agreed to be on our show. And what a wonderful guest he was. So really, really excited to bring that interview to you listeners.
Yes. Cannot wait for you to hear it. It was a fabulous conversation. But first, before we get into that, right after the break, we've got a new game that we're going to play. So stick around. We'll be right back.
Doctors, are you tired of 3 a.m. pages disrupting your beauty sleep? Meet Pager Pillow, the ultimate nighttime companion for burnt-out physicians. With Pager Pillow's patented SleepSpeak technology, it answers patient calls after hours in your voice, giving evidence-based and compassionate advice like, take 2 ibuprofen, rest, ice, compress, elevate, and call me in the morning. It even has built-in ambient wave sounds to help lull you off to dreamland so you can be back to your perky self at morning rounds without having to chug a venti espresso. With PagerPillow, you'll finally get the uninterrupted sleep you deserve. And the best part is, your patients won't even miss you. Visit sirsnoozealot.zzz and sign up for a free 7-night trial today. Experience the magic of continuous sleepy time without that annoying beep, beep, beep. PagerPillow, because your beauty sleep shouldn't be a distant dream. Free trial available for first-time users only. PagerPillow is not liable for any misdiagnoses or adverse health events arising from the use of SleepSpeak technology. Doctors are advised to increase their malpractice insurance coverage to the maximum allowable amount before using PagerPillow. Side effects may include excessive napping, unusually cheerful morning demeanor, increased job satisfaction, happiness, joy, exhilaration, improved patient outcomes, and world peace. PagerPillow. We take all, so you don't have to.
Thank you. Welcome back, listeners, to Tech It to the Limit. We're so excited to have you back here with us. And in honor of the conversation that we got to have with Dr. Ehrenfeld in this episode, we decided to talk a little bit and poke a little bit of fun at the bureaucracy that is our healthcare industry in America. And so we have come up with a brand new game that we are so excited to bring to you. Sarah, can you tell us a little bit about it?
I sure can, Elliot. I'll be thrilled to. So as you mentioned, in the spirit of overregulation of our industry, we've come up with a game called Red Tape Riddles. So Elliot and I are going to take turns reading a riddle about a red tape organization. They're all federal organizations that have regulatory oversight over the healthcare industry. And for every riddle that we correctly solve, we earn a point. And because Elliot and I are uber competitive, we're going to each riddle me this or riddle you that four different times. And then we have a tiebreaker in case there's a tie. Is that right?
Yeah, I think I'm more competitive than you are.
Of course you are. So, but you know, it's not really a competition unless there's winners and losers. And you're not really a winner unless you have a prize. So what's the prize, Elliot, for winning this Red Tape Riddle game?
The prize is a lot of fun. The loser will change their LinkedIn profile to be that of the president of the winner's fan club. So if I win, and I will, Sarah will change her position on LinkedIn, her current position on LinkedIn, to be the president of my fan club. Mm. And that's going to include updating her profile banner image to make it look legit.
Yeah, to make it look like I'm one of those stalker fans, you know?
Yes.
Soccer fan. And
yes, yes. Like a unsanctioned fan club.
Unsanctioned. Yeah. Yeah. It's not at the real fan club, Elliot Wilson fan club. It's just, you know, obsessive creeper fans fan club. Okay. We all get the gist. Okay.
All right. Well, good luck, Sarah.
Yeah. Good luck.
Number one fan.
Elliot with second tease for telehealth. All right. I'm going to go first since you're being snarky. So riddle me this, riddle me that. Elliot, here's your first riddle. And you can't just say the acronym. You need to like actually spell out the name of the organization, okay?
I got to know the organization. Okay.
Yes, sir. Okay. I fight the bugs and viruses. My alerts are quite precise. But understanding my guidelines might take a PhD twice. Who am I?
That's got to be the Center for Disease Control.
And
CDC, Center for Disease Control. And this is, you know, can I just side note? I just want to get angry. Like, that's not the only federal agency that has more letters that they squeeze into a three-letter acronym.
Right. Yeah. So this isn't part of the acronym, but it is part of the agency's name.
I want partial credit. The okay. Center for Disease Control and Communication? Prevention.
Yes. Prevention. Okay.
Center for Disease Control and Prevention.
Because you're an elder millennial and you just can't live without a participant ribbon and partial credit, I'll give you half a point.
What?
Yeah.
What? I said it.
Yeah, after you guessed incorrectly.
Oh, no. Come on.
So you get to have two goes at
it? This game is under protest.
Oh, my God.
This game is under protest. Okay. I want 3/4 of a point.
You're so... What is this? Like 1776?
Like, I wrote it down with my quill pen.
Right. Okay. We're just going to throw that one out. Okay.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. Because we can't agree. All right. Here's another one.
Wait. No. Oh. What?
You don't get 3/4 of a point. This negotiation is over. You should have been satisfied with half a point. All right. This one's another easy one. Okay. I care for veterans with services they deserve. My wait times might test their nerve. Who am I?
The Department of Veteran Affairs.
Yes! Ding, 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 ding. You get a full point, Mr. Millennial.
Full point.
All right.
Yes.
Now it's
all right,
your
good.
Turn.
All righty. I guard your health with strict oversight. inspecting things both day and night. From pills to produce, I ensure the way. Can you guess my name today?
Oh, I love it. The rhymes. Federal Drug Administration. No, Food and Drug Administration.
You get half a point.
For crying out loud.
No, you get a full point.
Oh, wow. You're so compassionate.
I am magnanimous.
Thanks for the pity vote. All right.
All right. The score is 1-1.
1-1. Okay. Here's another somewhat easy one for you. I deliver healthcare to Native Americans with a service quite old. My efficiency is a running joke, often I am told. Who am I?
So I want to say the Department of Indian Affairs, but it's not the Department of Indian Affairs anymore. It's the...
That's if you were like Andrew Jackson.
Right, right. Exactly. I mean, that's how it started. So when did they finally updated it? Oh my God. I am not woke.
We all have opportunities.
We do. We all have opportunities. This is mine to get it right, mm-hmm. and I might not. Mm-hmm. The Department of Native American Affairs.
Mm-mm. The Indian Health Service. That's right. It's
that
offensive.
Feels worse.
It is.
That feels worse.
Yep. Yep, that just goes to show you nothing changes in Washington, you know?
Ugh.
Okay, my turn.
All righty, here you go. I aid the needy from town to town. Supporting healthcare, I wear the crown. From clinics to grants, I lead the way. Guess my name. What do you say?
From clinics to grants? Aiding the needy?
From town to town.
I was going to guess National Institutes of Health, but I know that's not right. The grants thing is throwing me off. Office of Rural Health?
It's HRSA. So close, though.
Okay. What does HRSA stand for our listeners?
That's the Health Resources and Services Administration. So, fun fact, talking about digital health, HRSA is what funds the telehealth resource centers around the country.
Super fun fact.
Yes. So, we love the telehealth resource centers. Yeah.
Alrighty, so it's 1-1, round 3, right?
1-1, starting round three. Oh, this is nice. I'm still in this. Go.
Yeah, you are. You go. All right. I protect you from dangerous products in your cart. My recalls are like finding hidden hazards in your mart. Who am I?
Consumer Protection Agency?
Ooh, so close. Consumer Product Safety Commission, the CPSC. Yeah, I get their newsletter like every day and tries to scare me that like the 20 things that I bought at Target yesterday are going to kill my child.
Oh my gosh, you're serious. You actually do get their newsletter.
I do get their newsletter.
Oh
yeah,
my gosh,
it's actually quite helpful.
I thought you were being ironic.
No. It does not drive my anxiety whatsoever. All right, round 3
man.
For me.
Okay, all right, okay. I make healthcare affordable if you can endure my forms. Deciphering my rules might make you wish for fewer norms. Who am I?
The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
I feel like you should not have been able to get that one that easily.
Oh, come on. That's an easy one. Mm. You're just jellyfish.
There's lots of organizations that give out forms. I'm just saying.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, they're all in Washington, too, by the way. All right, Sherpa's in the lead, 2-1, as we head into the final round 4. Will Elliot's second T is for telehealth survive? All right. I'm going to choose... Okay, I'm trying to choose one that I think you'll know the answer to. Okay?
That's Gee, not too thanks. Big. That's not at all condescending.
I want this game to go on. It's fun. All right, here we go. I prioritize healthcare quality with reports so grand. You'll need a research team to fully understand. Who am I?
National Health Quality Institute?
The Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. Ugh. AHRQ. Sorry.
That's esoteric.
What? Okay, that was one of my faves. Like, I actually subscribe to their newsletter.
You have government agency trading cards, don't you?
I do, yeah. And they have, like, the faces of their administrators.
Yes.
Okay. Give me one.
God, I've got Merrick Garland's rookie card.
I mean, technically you lost already, but I want my final one.
Wow. Gosh. Wow. Wow. That's really hurtful.
Even with that half a point and a 3/4 of a point, I would still be winning for the record. Give me a tough one.
I fight cancer with a kitten's ferocity in a bag. My funding for research can be quite a drag. Who am I?
Is this like a prank? Is this like a you've been punked?
No.
Is it the National Institutes of Health?
It is not. That's a what goose is it? Egg for you on that one.
Goose egg? Oh, yeah, I just wanted to say that. What was it? What is it?
That would be the National Cancer Institute.
Oh, duh. All my oncology friends, like all two of them, are like, Sarah, come on. They're like shouting at the radio.
So I find this entire game to be under protest because it started with a dispute over the very
first. Oh, for crying out
loud.
Are you really doing that right
I'm
now?
I'm just saying this isn't, I think
you know
that
what?
This is more of a tie than anything.
Don't make
I had to answer more
a piece
questions.
Of avocado toast and lick your wounds.
Salty. So salty.
Dude, even if I gave you the CDC, we'd still be tied. Should I give it to you just so we can have some excitement? Would that make you feel good?
No. Yes.
Okay, come on. Lightning round.
All right, lightning
round. This is
round.
Like the most messed up game. We each get one more, okay? And if it's a tie at the end, then we both have to become one another's fans. Deal?
Deal. Fine.
Okay, cool.
All right.
Fine. All right. Here you go. I oversee all things health with a bureaucracy so wide, navigating my programs might require a Sherpa as your guide. Who am I?
The Department of Health and Human Services.
Yes! Ding, 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 ding! You got it! I'm so proud of you! Good job! It's even mentioned in our interview today. That was going to be my clue.
All
right, give me one that's like within reach, you know?
Yes.
I feel like we're both going to end up becoming one another's fan club presidents.
I have two different riddles in case you don't get the first one.
This is such a millennial competition. Just do your best, honey. We love you. Remember, you're special.
I turn health research dreams into reality if you can brave my hurdles with practicality. Who am I?
Health research? I should know, but I don't know.
In a quest for knowledge, I lead the way. Advancing health come what may. Through research and science, my work is known. Can you guess the agency shown?
No.
Oh my gosh. I'm totally going to win.
You're so effed up, dude.
I'm so going
to
win.
I handed this to you on a silver platter.
And you're going to be so upset, too. It's the National Institutes
of
Health.
Is it the NIH? Oh my God! I just said it! The NIH.
Thank you so much. We here at Elliott Wilson really appreciate your work as president of my fan club.
You are such a narcissist. You are not. If you don't become my fan club's president, I'm breaking up with you.
Okay, joke's on you. I'm already the president of your fan club.
Aww. Hey, you know what? I was walking by my neighbor's house today, and she was wearing a picture of our other neighbor on her t-shirt, and it was, like, all over. You know, like, neighbor, 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 all over. And I was like, ugh, why is so-and-so's face on all of your wardrobe? She's like, it's her birthday today, and I'm her number one fan. I'm like, wow, that is impressive.
That's intense.
So, you know, maybe you just need to get, like, my face all over your shirt, and then you could prove it.
Yes. Yes. I think that's what we should do. We should definitely have a series of fashion items showcasing the face of the other person.
I think we could do bumper stickers at the very least. Like, I am a president of the Elliott Wilson fan club. I would put that on my car.
Thanks. Thanks. Likewise. I would put that on my car, cool. too.
All righty. Well, do we agree that we're all winners here
we are
in
all
millennial
winners.
Land?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I cannot wait to update my LinkedIn profile, but more so, I cannot wait for our listeners to hear this interview with Jesse Ehrenfeld. It was so much fun to do. Stick around. We'll be right back.
The record, we sounded a lot more intelligent in that interview than we did in this real game.
This Pride Month, while everyone's slapping rainbows on everything from sneakers to cereal boxes, we're here to bring you something truly transformative for your practice. Introducing the Quantum Understanding and Empathy Enhancement Reeducation for Advanced Fluency. Queer AF, giving you pride in your practice. Tired of feeling like your care for LGBTQIA patients is stuck in the Stone Age? Wish you could upgrade from outdated practices to something as fabulous as your patients deserve? Then get ready for Queer AF, the virtual reality system that's as advanced as it is inclusive. With our intersectionality simulator, you'll step into a multiverse of perspectives, experiencing patient scenarios from across the rainbow spectrum. Feel the power of true understanding and leave those old biases in the past as you become the physician you always felt you were inside. Speaking of biases, meet our bias corrective interface. It doesn't just give real-time emotional feedback, it also gives you a little shock whenever your implicit bias rears its ugly head. Just a small zap to keep your empathy on track. Who knows? You may find you like it. And because staying current is key, our Adaptive Treatment Advisory provides real-time updates on the latest practice guidelines and medical research for LGBTQIA+ care. Because nothing says I care like being informed and up to date. Understanding that care for gay people is more than just HIV tests. This Pride Month, don't just wear the rainbow, understand it. Transform your practice with Queer AF and give your patients the care they truly deserve. Possible side effects may include uncontrollable shame at the absurdity of past practices, a sudden urge to dismantle systemic biases, and a newfound appreciation for intersectional activism. Users may experience brief existential crises when realizing how much they still need to unlearn. Other side effects include intense irritation at rainbow capitalism and spontaneous participation in pride parades. Queer AF is not responsible for any gratification caused by shock therapy. Queer AF, because real pride is more than just a sticker. Attention troops! Today we're deploying a very special guest on our show, Dr. Jesse Ehrenfeld, the 178th president of the American Medical Association. Picture a combat veteran who traded his dog tags for a stethoscope, and you're on target with Dr. Ehrenfeld. He's been on the front lines of battlefields and operating rooms, and now he's leading the charge on behalf of physicians. As the senior associate dean of the Medical College of Wisconsin and commander of the Advancing a Healthier Wisconsin Endowment, Dr. Ehrenfeld is on a mission to take down health inequities and secure a brighter future for all. A fearless advocate for LGBTQ health, he's been waging war against disparities with the tactical precision of a five-star general. During his tenure as AMA president, he launched the AMA's recovery plan for Americans' physicians, targeting enemy forces like broken Medicare payments, cumbersome prior authorizations, and physician burnout. He's like the Rambo of healthcare, tackling these issues head-on with unmatched grit and determination. But that's not all. With over 275 peer-reviewed publications and 22 clinical textbooks under his belt, wow, Dr. Ehrenfeld's credentials are more decorated than a general's uniform. He's also an adjunct professor at Vanderbilt and the Uniformed Services University of Health Sciences, proving he's got the tactical know-how both in the field and in the classroom. And as the first openly gay AMA president, Dr. Ehrenfeld is breaking barriers and setting new standards of excellence. So strap in and prepare for an intel-packed debrief as we delve into his field experiences and visionary plans for the future of medicine. Let's give a salute to Dr. Jesse Ehrenfeld. May I call you Jesse?
Oh, please do. Thanks for that really lovely introduction, Elliot.
It's our pleasure. So, Jesse, one of the things that we love to do here on Tech It to the Limit is we like to laugh and we love puns. And so we like to have our guests offer up their best pun, their favorite dad joke. Do you have one that you can share with us?
Well, you know, Elliot, it's funny. I was in the operating room yesterday and I had a little girl come in who had swallowed 10 quarters. So I turned to my nurse and I said, how's she doing? And the nurse says, no change yet. Yeah, all joking aside, I've got two boys, Ethan, he's 5, Asher, he's 16 months, Ethan had a birthday last weekend, and I have a lot of dad jokes, and actually at his birthday party, this poor little boy, he comes up and he's like afraid to take a piece of birthday cake, and he goes, Dr. Ehrenfeld, every time I eat birthday cake, I get heartburn, and I said, Cooper, next time take off the candles.
Wow, double trouble. I think you're our first guest, Jesse, who's had the 1-2 punch with the dad.
Yeah.
Very nice. Very nice. Fantastic. So I'm going to kick it off with our first serious question.
Yeah.
Jesse, as you wrap up your term as AMA president, what's been the most rewarding part of your leadership journey, and what legacy do you hope to leave behind?
Well, thanks for that. You know, as I arrive at the end of my presidency, it's been a year on the road, a year meeting with physicians, a year of just seeing and hearing about all of the challenges, big and small, that face our healthcare system. And what's really clear to me is that we've got a system in crisis, right? Like the Change Healthcare cyber attack, the ensuing reimbursement challenges just could not have come at a worse time. You know, down the street from me, Ascension Health System, their electronic health record's still down because of a cybersecurity event. But if you think about it, you know, we're years in a confluence of preventable events into what's made it the worst possible moment, right? So physicians, we've known for some time that our Medicare payment system that reimburses physicians for the care that we provide was failing, that it's creating severe stress financially for physicians, particularly those in private practice who are the backbone of our healthcare safety net, especially in rural parts of the country like where I live in Wisconsin and other underserved communities. If you adjust for inflation, right, you've seen the graphs, the payment rate to physicians who care for Medicare patients, it's gone down since my first year of medical school, 29% since 2001. You add on top of all of that, burnout amongst my colleagues, driven by onerous burdens like prior authorization. You know, 2 in 3 doctors at the height of the pandemic said that they were burnt out, according to a Mayo Clinic Stanford AMA survey. We've never seen that level of burnout ever recorded before. So with all of those pressures riding on the shoulders of physicians, we have to do something different. So for me, this year has been about how do we lead the charge to fix things? And in my meetings with physicians across the country, they see us need to do this work. And so we've been leading the charge around trying to make sure that the digital tools that, you know, you guys talk a lot about on your show actually work, that we can actually get paid when we use them. You know, if we don't have another congressional extender, telehealth payment will end at the end of calendar 24. We can't let that happen. We've got to fix prior authorization to make sure that patients can get what they need. We've got to reduce burnout across the professions, not just physicians, but all health professions. We've got to get rid of the stigma when people say they know that they need help, but they're afraid to get it. And we've got to get a Medicare payment system into a place that actually it works, it's rational, and it promotes innovation, and it promotes thriving physician practices. So, you know, as I think about where we are, we've got an aging population. You all know that. The demographics are not in our favor. But we've got an aging physician workforce. 45% of physicians are over 55. So if we're going to get on the path to sustainability and on a path to a health system that works for patients and physicians, we have to make sure that we tackle all of these things. We have to make sure we expand the physician workforce. And it's been such an incredible journey to do this job this past year, to lead these conversations. You mentioned I'm the first openly gay president of the AMA. It's been so rewarding, so meaningful to be invited into conversations and spaces that the AMA has just not been present in before. And representation matters. Visibility is so important. And having this job at this moment in our nation is something that I've taken very, very seriously. And it's been a humbling privilege.
Well, there's quite a bit to unpack there, for sure. You know, but that last bit that you kind of mentioned there is a great segue. I mean, to what I was kind of curious about. So I'm a gay dad too, and so I was really excited to talk to you.
We should start a Facebook group, by the way. For that.
Life goals, Elliot.
Yes, that's right. So we're recording this for our June episode, right? So June is Pride Month, and you've been such a strong advocate for LGBTQ health. I'm curious as to what you think the strides that have been made during your term. You said it was very rewarding, but what tangible strides have been made to improve healthcare for LGBTQ individuals, and what's still left to do? And what are the unique challenges and opportunities posed by the advent of digital health and AI in the provision of healthcare for queer folks?
Yeah, so I'll say the most obvious, easy to grasp, tangible win for LGBTQ people that happened this year was the FDA removing the categorical restrictions on blood donations for men who have sex with men. And this was a decade of advocacy, and the AMA was front and center. We were not the only folks engaged in this conversation. There were a lot of partners at the table arguing for the science that obviously had evolved since the 80s. When this ban was originally placed, no longer made sense. It's not complete because there are still FDA rules that don't make sense around donation of tissues. So cornea, human cells, other tissue-based products, where there still is a ban, where the guidelines that the FDA has still requires men who have sex with men to defer that donation for 5 years since their last sexual contact. Doesn't make sense. So while we've made progress, there's still work to do, even in that one very narrow space around blood donation and tissue donation around the FDA. I will tell you, though, actually, in September, my husband and I had this incredibly moving experience of, for the first time ever in our lives, donating blood. And we went to our local blood center and, you know, signed up together. And we did want to draw some attention to this. And so we had some media there. And I felt awful for the poor phlebotomist who was there trying to find my vein. And I'm an anesthesiologist, so I kind of do this all the time. And I also do get to the gym, and I've got pretty good options. And if you're trying to actually draw somebody's blood on camera, it can be a little stress provoking. And so this poor woman is just kind of fishing around. And actually on the TV segment, you can see the look on my face as she's like digging around in my arm trying to find the vessel. But she found it after a while. At one moment she said, you know, doctor, I don't think this is going to happen. And I said, listen, this is really a moment where failure is not an option. So just keep going. And she pushed through and we got it. And but, you know, it was very moving for a bunch of reasons. One, you know, one of the first major policy issues I was involved in at the AMA as a medical student was this issue. Mm-hmm. What was the AMA stance? What was our advocacy? What was our policy? And it didn't happen overnight, right? It took time, but it did happen. And, you know, I mentioned I've got two kids. Our older son, Ethan, who's five now, you know, he was born at 29 weeks and spent 49 days in the NICU and has done great. But, you know, it was a very stressful moment. And there was a moment early in his life where he needed a blood transfusion. And knowing that neither my husband nor I could donate blood, and our little boy, this gorgeous human, needed blood was just heartbreaking, right? And, you know, fortunately, Ethan's done great. He got the blood that he needed because of a volunteer donor, obviously. And it all sort of comes full circle. So there definitely has been progress. We continue to push for everybody across America to get access to high-quality evidence-based care, regardless of their gender, their sexual orientation. Increasingly, as you know, I'm not sure how much you've talked about in this podcast, there are threats. There are legislators, state legislative efforts to ban gender-affirming care, to step in and into the most intimate decisions that patients need to make to drive those conversations. And we think that decisions about healthcare ought to be made, shared decisions between a patient, their family, and their physicians without a politician or a judge inserting themselves into the exam room. So we've got a lot of work to do as there are these attacks on healthcare decision-making, both in the LGBTQ healthcare as well as reproductive health space. But, you know, I'm optimistic. I do think that we will ultimately create a system where people are able to access what they need. I also will say that, you know, I'm not the only very public physician, LGBTQ leader making visibility a thing. We've got the Assistant Secretary of Health and Human Services, Admiral Rachel Levine, the most senior official in the administration, in any administration, who's transgender. And she's an incredible physician, incredibly talented leader, making some real progress over at HHS. So I think there is still a lot of work to do, but certainly I'm happy with some of the progress we've made this year.
Thank you for that, Jesse. Thinking about your transition out of leadership at the AMA and thinking about how at least our system of government tends to work, where when the administration changes, sometimes the incoming administration does everything they can to unravel what the previous one did. And we end up just being somewhat stagnant or oscillating between two poles. Are you confident that the legacy you're leaving behind at AMA in terms of advocating for LGBTQ health is going to stand firm after you transition?
Yeah, you know, you talk about ping pong with the administrations and rules, and it's a real challenge in Washington. We don't have that problem at the AMA, and I'll tell you why. I should just note for your listeners who don't know much about how we work and how we set policy. The AMA is the most influential, oldest, you know, group of physicians across the country. We've been around since 1847. And we are a democratic, open, transparent organization. Twice a year, we convene 190-plus states, specialty societies, pediatrics, the Endocrine Society, surgery, Wisconsin, Montana, Idaho, everybody. U.S. Public Health Service, all of the military services, everybody is represented, and everybody has a vote. And our policies are debated. There's passion. We talk about the evidence, and we do what's right for America's patients and America's physicians. And the great thing about that process, that democratic process, is it's powerful. And our policy is not subject to the whims of one leader. It's enduring because it's vetted, it's debated, it changes, evidence changes, and that's right. That's what we should do. We did not have positive, strong, supportive LGBTQ health policy for decades, you know, for the first big chunk of the AMA's history, but we do now. And I don't have any concern that that's going to go away or change substantively. My role as AMA president this year is to be the biggest champion as our spokesperson for our policies. And I have no doubt that when I hand things off to the next leader, that he will be as effective as I am in carrying that torch forward.
That's great. Before we get off this topic, I just wanted to circle back to a concept that I think we touched on a little bit earlier, but maybe not. It's actually something that I struggle with my own PCP, which is I have a straight doctor who I trust for a lot of things, but I don't necessarily trust for treating me as a gay man or treating me as a queer individual. And I'm curious as your thoughts around culturally competent care, and training for physicians. And then on top of that, as we have this need for culturally competent care all over the country, but we are very concentrated in our ability to provide that in certain geographical locations, how do you see digital tools helping to connect those gaps, those geographical gaps? And what do you think about that?
Yeah, so great set of questions. We need diverse healthcare teams. That is a foundational point and principle of our work around workforce development and supporting patient care and lifting up health equity. We know that patients writ large from diverse communities, from underserved communities, from low resource communities do better. Patients do better when they are cared for by diverse healthcare teams, full stop, period. There is data, right? So as we think about the workforce, that is a powerful motivator to make sure that we have diverse talent coming into the pathways that lead to medical school, residency training, and ultimately full-time practice. You know, on the LGBTQ health side, we've got a ways to go. Unfortunately, for decades, if there was any content at all in medical school about LGBTQ health needs, you know, it might be an hour and it might be a talk that was about HIV. That has changed markedly. Now, most schools have content, it's integrated, it's appropriate, it's culturally competent, but that doesn't necessarily influence the practice of the million doctors that are taking care of folks around the nation today. And there is a lot of catch-up work that we need to do around how to provide culturally competent care, not just for LGBTQ patients and queer patients, but all patients, right? That's a journey that we need to continue to push on. So there definitely are ways to go. I will tell you there's interesting data for LGBTQ people since you brought up, Elliot. There's a bit of a disconnect. So patients don't understand why coming out is important. But if you don't come out and a physician or a healthcare team member doesn't know who you are, then they can't provide you the best evidence-based care, right? They won't offer you HIV testing and PrEP and anoscopy and other things that might be appropriate based on your activities and who you are and what you're doing. You know, I'm an anesthesiologist. People ask me all the time, like, what does it matter in anesthesia? Well, turns out that anesthesia is really important for surgery. Making sure that there's a good plan for recovery and support and family and knowing who that is and who's going to pick you up and who's going to get you home and what is that social situation like is also probably equally as important. And if I don't ask those questions and I don't know how to interact with my patients and their loved ones in the pre-op holding room, then that's as much a problem as anything else. So anyway, patients often don't know that coming out actually does impact the care that we deliver and why it's important. And then a lot of physicians and other healthcare workers are afraid to ask, right? They don't want to offend grandma. You know, they weren't taught how do you ask these hard questions. But there's data, study after study, that shows even in rural America, patients do not mind being asked. They understand why in a healthcare context these questions are important. And so we've been trying to do a lot of education to try to lift up those conversations and help make sure that people have those skills. You know, on the digital health side, you know, there are more and more apps and opportunities for LGBTQ people to get healthcare that's trustworthy, that's knowledgeable, that's compassionate, that might not be right next door. And so I think that's really been transformative for a lot of people who have had to travel long distances to find culturally competent care. I remember this is a while back, probably 7 or 8 years, I was talking to an endocrinologist, and they actually practice in Northern Virginia outside of DC, and they told me they had a patient, a trans patient, who went to 5 other endocrinologists. You don't know exactly the details, but turned away, said no, you don't know how to care for you, don't want to care for you, versions of that, right? And you think about that, and you have one or two of those experiences, but imagine being told that 5 times as you're just trying to get through your day, access the care that you need. So we have a long way to go. I do think there's a real opportunity. I think digital health has so much that we need it to do to support the capacity that we don't have today across lots of aspects of healthcare. And I'm obviously very enthusiastic about it. I think AI is going to change everything. And probably the most under-resourced, overlooked communities have the most to gain from some of these tools.
Speaking of AI, the AMA has drafted principles to guide the ethical and effective use of AI in healthcare. Can you tell us a bit more about these principles and how they aim to ensure that AI enhances rather than hinders patient care?
Yeah, so probably put a link to the website on your podcast would be great because it's a long document and that would be helpful. But fundamentally, we need to make sure that we have AI that is developed and deployed and put out in a way that actually is safe and ethical and equitable and responsible and transparent. So the key concepts are about oversight, right? Like, what's the governance around AI so that we mitigate harm? What does government need to do? What does non-government need to do? Transparency. This is not explainability. And you guys know, and I'm sure your listeners know, explainability is how does the algorithm work? What's the deep learning doing? What are the weights on the, you know, different features in the tool? Explainability is hard, and that's evolving. But transparency, we have to demand, right? I should never walk into an operating room and turn on a ventilator and not know that there's an algorithm that's trying to optimize my ventilation parameters, right? Because if that ever happens, that I really think all is lost. Because then if there's a problem, there's no way I can be the human in the loop to supervise and correct something when it goes off the rails. And that transparency point, and let me dwell on it for a minute, because you know, we can learn such an important lesson from another industry when they did not do this. And that's aviation. So you guys probably know that the 737 MAX original problem that led to the tragic loss of 2 aircraft, hundreds of lives were lost, was because of an AI safety system. And the new planes, right, bigger engines, different spot on the wings, it creates more lift. And so the nose on those planes, the 737 MAX, it just has this tendency to go up in flight because there's more lift. That's all I know about engineering aeronautics. So Boeing recognized this, and they didn't redesign the plane. They built an AI safety system. And what it does is it just gently pushes the nose of the plane back down when it detects it going up during normal flight. That was fine until there was a sensor malfunction and the sensor thought the plane was going up. It was flying normally and it crashed those 2 planes into the ground. Mm-hmm. The point here that's really shocking is the pilots had no idea that the system existed. There was nothing in the operations manual. There was no training. We can never allow that mistake to happen in healthcare. So we have to demand transparency. The other related principle that we've put out is around disclosure, right? So, you know, when you're using and experiencing these tools, how do you disclose it? What do you document about that? We have principles around privacy and security. You know, we have to make sure that data is secure and that there are systems are resilient when there are cyber issues. We also have principles around bias. A lot of concern about how do we make sure that AI tools don't worsen health inequities? How do we make sure that they're leveraged to elevate equitable health outcomes? How do we mitigate bias in algorithms? And then liability, making sure that liability, when a tool does cause harm, is placed in the right spot. And that may not always be on the end user. And in fact, in many circumstances, it's probably on the implementer, the developer, or somebody farther upstream. But if we get that liability point wrong, it'll kill the market, right? Who's going to buy a tool if something goes wrong and you're stuck holding the bag as the end user, but it was really the developer, the implementer, the manufacturer that did it? So those are the principles in a nutshell. Again, there's a large document that you can link to, and I would encourage folks to check it out. It's not totally new. We've been working on policy since 2018, but we did a big refresh in November that sort of brought us up to date.
Thanks, Jesse, for that really thorough response. And we will definitely link to those AI principles in the show notes for our readers who haven't had a chance to look at them yet. I know Elliot's already read them by the fireside with a glass of Cabernet. So check.
Pinot Noir, but sure.
Yeah, Pinot Noir, sorry. So I actually had a follow-up question, Jesse, before we segue into our next topic. Talking about these concepts of transparency, explainability, disclosure, they're very interrelated. Is there anything that the AMA has done to provide education to the physician workforce regarding how to talk to patients about AI and how it's impacting that shared decision-making process or how it's monitoring their care? Frequently, when I work with physicians and nurses at Mayo Clinic Health System, they're asking for tools of like, how do I explain this to my patients, right? Oh, well, AI recommended that I call and schedule you for this procedure. That doesn't sit well, right? So what kind of bedside skills or website skills do physicians need to successfully implement these tools with patients and sort of ensure that they're adopted, not just by physicians, but also by patients and caregivers?
Yeah, and that's a really important set of questions. And I think it's an evolving space, right? So certainly we have a whole set of tools on our education hub. The AMA Ahead Hub is just where we have all of our sort of physician-facing content. It pulls from the JAMA network of journals, as well as, like, in fact, we have a great partnership with some of the LGBTQ health centers around the country to fill in some of the gaps where we think it's really important. So we do have tools for physicians. So if you've got listeners out there who are looking for places around, you know, how do you do some of the integration? How do you do some of the policy making work? How do you, you know, what's a practical guide to integrating these things? We've got those tools on our website and encourage folks to check them out. I think, you know, it is an evolving question though about, you know, what should you disclose to a patient about how a decision was arrived at and what tools were used? And I think that is a larger societal question as it relates to the generation of content. I think, you know, even in the, you know, you guys are kind of in the media business. I think there are a lot of questions about, you know, AI generated news items and summaries and media content, and how should that be disclosed to readers and consumers? And I think they're a related set of issues really in healthcare around what should we be telling patients there. I think we don't really have clarity as of right now. What I will say is it's essential that we maintain trust. And if we use these tools in a way that erodes that trust, either on the professional side or on the consumer side, it will halt innovation. And that would be tragic, right? Because we need these tools. We just do not have enough people or time or space or clinics to deliver care the same way that we've done for 100 years and be successful, right? There are 83 million Americans that don't have access to a primary care doctor. And the only way that we're going to expand capacity of our primary care system is to use these tools, right? Digital health tools, generative AI tools, other ways to re-engineer the system. So there's a lot at stake here. There really is. But I will say that, you know, I've also seen that disconnect. And I sometimes tell this story. I was at an AI conference maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and this really excited developer came up to me afterwards. And he's like, oh, doctor, I've got this AI algorithm, and it'll tell you, you know, if your patient has colon cancer and if you need to do surgery. And I said, okay, well, like, how's it work? I said, well, I don't know. It's a deep learning black box. I can't tell you how it works. I said, okay, so I'm going to tell my mom, you've got colon cancer. We're going to operate on you. I can't tell you why, but the machine algorithm says we should do that. Like, what patient's going to say yes to that? And what third party payer is going to reimburse me for the surgery? Like nobody. So
that's like the modern day snake oil.
Yeah. So there are these, there are these disconnects. What I would say they tend to be in the more unsophisticated, you know, organizations or entrepreneurs or developers, but there's still elements of that where people who don't really understand the clinical workflow or the implications on patients are making some of these design decisions that sometimes then make the technology more of a burden than an asset. We can't let that happen, which is why, you know, we're pretty adamant that physicians ought to be at the table throughout the design and development and deployment cycle of all these digital tools.
I want to run an idea by you and from some of the concepts that you were bringing up before, especially around mitigating bias and ensuring the right level of liability. So to me, it's not just the developers, right? It's also the implementers and that have a responsibility in ensuring that it's deployed properly and not causing more harm or whether, especially unintentionally. But I think we need to live in the reality that there will be times when AI is deployed or digital tools are deployed and do cause harm. And when that happens, how do we ensure protection for provider organizations to allow them to take on this work and deploy these tools with a lens toward restorative justice so that if and when something happens, they are not in such a place of liability that they are too scared to implement these tools?
So we actually this is coming crashing together in a really unfortunate way, and liability is a really huge part of the conversation right now about AI, and when there is liability because of it, like an inaccurate model or the misuse of a model, you know, the questions around who bears responsibility is really important. So, you know, if the AI tool, right, Elliot, take this prescription. You know, it's looked at your data and the meds and whatever, and then you have a reaction, right? Who bears the burden of responsibility? Is it me as the prescriber? Is it the company that developed the algorithm? Is the team that trained the tool? I think there's a lot of question that is not answered. Unfortunately, we've had two things happen in April that are concerning to me. So you both probably know that Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act, a really important part of the Affordable Care Act, right? It's the non-discrimination piece. HHS, their Office of Civil Rights, issued a long-awaited non-discrimination rule. And that rule has a lot of good stuff in it, but there's a very problematic provision that creates a new liability for physicians who use AI-enabled technologies or any other clinical algorithm that potentially results in discriminatory harm. And so what the rule does is it creates a new duty on physicians, and it creates this risk of penalties if they rely on an algorithm-enabled tool that results in discriminatory harm. So the challenge is, you know, as a physician, how do I think about that new requirement if I'm incorporating a tool in my practice? Because right now, in many circumstances, I don't have the level of transparency to understand where that discriminatory harm might come from. And in an equally concerning development, the Federation of State Medical Boards, they said that the physician is ultimately and solely responsible for the use of AI, and the physician should be held accountable for any harms that occur. So, you know, in general, we agree with the Federation's guidance on AI deployment, transparency, development, all those things. But we disagree that the physician is only and ultimately solely responsible. And we're very worried that if we don't get this liability question right, and there's going to be litigation, right? We're already starting to see these cases pop up because there's just not much case law sort of dealing with this. You know, the individual or the entity who's best positioned to know the system risks, who's best positioned to mitigate that harm, they should be the ones that are on the hook for the liability. And that might be the developer. It might be the end user, right? If I misuse a tool, fine. But if I use something as directed and there's a problem with the underlying data that came from a company that licensed it from whoever, it's kind of hard to imagine that I as a physician should be solely liable. And I do worry that, again, if we don't get this right, who's going to want to use these tools? Who's going to want to use these tools to lift up health equity? And so we're at this point where this does need to get sorted out, and we'll see where it lands.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, talk about something that could put a real damper on the deployment of these tools. And certainly I have negotiated enough technology contracts from a provider organization's perspective to know that they all say for use as is. And so it's like on me as the deployer of these technologies, and, you know, where the technology companies have shed the liability.
And look, we're at a point. I was talking with the CMO of a large, well-known academic health system, and they said, we've got all these one-off point solutions, the algorithm for X thing in X specialty, and there's hundreds of them. Mm-hmm. And just from a management standpoint, like, you know, dealing with hundreds of individual one-off point solutions is not scalable, right? Mm-hmm. So we've got to shift to platforms. And I do think that might help with understanding performance and liability and some of those things in the long term, but we're not there today. No. And so how do we make that shift and that pivot? How do we get to adoption? How do we facilitate innovation without having this AI winter where people are afraid to use things, or, you know, compliance and legal say, don't use these things. I will tell you, there's a well-known portable ultrasound company out there. I won't name them, that has some pretty interesting technology that's very popular amongst some groups of physicians. And I still remember the email from my health system that said, you know, do not buy this tool on your own. Do not use this tool on your own. Do not bring this tool in the hospital, because they looked at the language around data share and data use and had significant concerns about the permissiveness of where patient data was going with this tool. So there's a lot out there that could get in the way of what we so desperately need, which is tools that expand the capacity of our existing teams. By the way, I haven't gotten there. We've already been talking for like 40 minutes. AI, in my view, the AMA's view, is augmented intelligence, not artificial intelligence. It's all about boosting the capabilities of our teams. And if I don't throw that in there, I will regret it. So there we have it. Augmented
and the physician listenership goes wild.
No, that's great. And I, you know, to the point about, you know, physician liability and the use of these things, right? While private practice is, you know, the backbone, as you mentioned earlier, there are so many health systems that employ physicians, right? And then dictate the use of some of these tools. And there's a whole question of liability around there. But I think take that a little bit further is, how do we get the physician voice, the provider voice, into the say of the development of healthcare technologies? And so how does the medical community ensure that their voices are heard and that their practical insight from, you know, the exam room shape the future of health tech, and what's preventing them? What's blocking them from being able to do that?
Well, 5 years ago, you know, if you had an analyst in a data set, you could get like venture funding out the nose. you guys know that. That's not the case today, right? So, you know, the spigot has been turned off a little bit. So I think, you know, folks are being a little bit more selective about, you know, what they're investing in. I think that helps. But the AMA has brought forward two approaches that we think are really important. One is, we have our Physician Innovation Network. The AMA PIN, it is free, it is online. It is a way for us to connect physicians, students, residents, trainees, other healthcare professionals with companies. And I wish we found some way to monetize this. We don't, because we've actually invested a lot in the platform. So we get no royalties, no money on it, but whatever. It is simply, it's a mission play. We want companies to engage with people who know what's going on the front lines. And so we've actually seen companies get connected with physicians and other healthcare team members and actually get to the market more quickly, you know, refine their solutions. And it's an online platform. You know, I think there are nearly 20,000 people on it already. We've got a bunch of institutional collaborators, which is great. We do some in real life events. So at Health and HIMSS and Vive and other meetings, occasionally we'll have a panel conversation. We'll actually bring some of these companies and physicians that have had success together to talk about, you know, why it worked. So again, that's a free service. Anybody anywhere in the world can log on and check it out. We'd encourage you to. We have some hosted conversations, a lot of great content. It's all free. The other thing that we've done is, we have an innovation company started in 2016 called Health 2047. Where did that name come from? Well, the AMA was founded in 1847. So you think forward 200 years, you get to 2047. It's not a startup. It's an innovation company, wholly owned subsidiary. It is informed by the insights of the AMA and our teams, our deep expertise to then birth startups. And so there are about a dozen companies that have come out of that innovation pipeline. And these are physician-driven organizations that obviously have a worldview similar to ours about how they can improve things. And again, it's a mission play, and we've put a lot of money into this thing. And I hope someday one of those companies goes public and some of that is returned. But at the end of the day, if something gets better around the ecosystem for physicians to make our lives easier, make practice better, reduce the burden of chronic disease, give people a little bit of their time back in every day, it'll be worth every penny that we've spent. So you can check out the website, health2047.com. They're out there as well. And those are just two ways that we're trying to elevate that physician voice in a very, very tangible approach.
Wow, that second one really is pretty cool. I mean, I know about the pin and love the content and the conversations that come out of that. But the innovation, the Health 2047, that's fascinating to me. It almost sounds like a mission-driven, physician-led accelerator for startup organizations. And I'm wondering, does Health 2047 make connections with venture and private equity to fund those coming out of what is essentially your incubator, I think?
It does. So there's the company Health 2047. There also is a fund. There's Health 2047 Capital Partners that has some shared leadership. And we have been able to attract household name venture and corporate dollars to support not just companies coming out of Health 2047, but other companies that we think, again, are aligned with the insights that we have and the mission that we want to promote, which is not all about making a buck, but about trying to make the world better for patients and physicians. It's called a double bottom line. I learned that at Stanford Business School.
This has been such a fun conversation. It's bittersweet to ask you our last question. As you look back on your tenure at AMA, what advice would you give to your successor and future medical leaders, even outside of the AMA, about balancing technological innovation with the human touch in healthcare?
Look, at the end of the day, when I'm sick, and I've been sick, I want to know that there's somebody who actually cares about me, somebody who can put their hand on my shoulder, who can tell me that's going to be okay. And an algorithm and an app and a tool can never do that. And so as I think about how we integrate these tools, we can't lose the humanity of the profession and of what it means to be a physician. And I don't think we will. I think that's what brings joy to so many physicians in practice each and every day. I was in the OR yesterday. I saw a bunch of patients. And the best part of my day was sitting down and talking with families about, what they're going to do when they got through this, what gave them joy, and what did they miss the most because of the illness that brought them to see me, and how could I help them get through this particular experience and hurdle. So with all these things, there's a balance, and I know we'll get there. We'll probably veer too far in one direction and then come back around full circle, because that's typically what we do with a lot of these new exciting things, particularly on the tech side. But at the end of the day, I'm optimistic about where we're going. I see such tremendous promise for the future of healthcare in America and across the globe. And I know without these technologies, we're going to really struggle. So I will continue to champion them in any way I can, even beyond my tenure here at the AMA.
Wow, that's great. I think you're right on there. I mean, obviously, I'm not a physician, but balancing that, understanding that in the end, practicing medicine and caring for people is a human connection, and patients need to feel that human connection. I think I use the hashtag, computers make care more human, because that's what that should be the goal, right?
Yeah.
And so I think I really, really appreciate those comments.
Yeah, Elliot, I just actually want to close with a personal story, if that's okay. I think to Jesse's point, so I see it's Mental Health Month. May is Mental Health Month, and okay, Mental Health Awareness Month. And I see a therapist every week. And sure, Most weeks I will talk to her on the phone. And I am so grateful that telemedicine is available to me and my provider gets paid for that. I can double up and go for a walk when I talk to her. So get some exercise, get some outside time. But on those really tough weeks when there's just something that's really got me down or worried, yeah. I ask if I can go see her in the office, and I have that option too. It's an incredible luxury because I live in the same town as my provider. But to your point, I crave that human connection at certain parts of my care journey. And so figuring out how to balance that is critical. So I really appreciate your closing comments.
Well, what I tell people is telehealth is great. By the way, my mom's a psychologist and she sees almost all of her patients on Zoom, which is very helpful because she doesn't have to leave the house and they don't have to drive to an office. But it's not a panacea. It is not everything for everyone. And we have a lot of people in the nation who can't use telehealth, who don't have the capacity or the tools or the bandwidth to access it. So it's important. We need it. We got to maintain it. But it's got to integrate into the system in ways that make sense, just like you described, Sarah.
Well, Jesse, thank you so much for the time you spent with us today. This has been a fabulous conversation. I can't wait to bring it to our listeners. Where can people find you if they want to read more from you or hear from you?
Well, first of all, don't believe everything you read online, but
the AMA
website. Yeah, exactly. LinkedIn, my personal website, drjesse.com, the AMA website, ama-assn.org. Is usually where you can find the latest and greatest.
Wonderful.
We are giddy with excitement to bring this interview to our listeners. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
And we're out. That was great. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, welcome back, listeners, to Tech It to the Limit. In keeping with tradition here on Tech It to the Limit, we're going to nosh on some hot, steamy chicken wisdom nuggets.
So tasty.
Elliot, so tasty. Why don't you kick us off? What were your nuggets? What were your top takeaways from that amazing conversation with Dr. Jesse Ehrenfeld?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head there. It was quite an amazing conversation.
You're speechless.
I know. I am completely and utterly speechless. He was fantastic to talk to. Talk about a man who easily navigates from one topic to another. I mean, he clearly talks about these topics a lot, and a fabulous conversationalist. I took a number of different things away from this conversation. So I'm just going to rattle off a few real quickly here and maybe dive into one and maybe dip it in for some little extra sauce before I chomp on that nugget. I was really moved by his story about the FDA removing the categorical restrictions on blood donations for men who have sex with men, which is just vestigial from the AIDS scare of the 80s where people got overly cautious, right? And then took a while for policy to catch up to reality. You know, that's something I didn't even realize had changed. It had become so ingrained in me that I was never going to give blood that I just stopped even looking to see if it had changed. So that was actually news to me, and I'm actually very much looking forward to going and giving blood. So that was cool. I liked his comments on culturally competent care. He called out that there's been great strides in the improvement of education recently for physicians around culturally competent care. I mean, it stemmed from the conversation around LGBTQ issues, but it really applies much more broadly to lots of different cultures. And that's all really well, fine, and dandy for new graduates. But he started the conversation talking about one of the crises that we have within medicine is the fact that nearly half of all physicians are 55 and older. Mm-hmm. And so, cool, we have new education out there that's improving for new graduates, but what's the mechanism to go back and re-educate those physicians that are out there right now, right?
Right. Yeah, we need some CME credits, people, right, for all you continuous professional development course directors out there. There's a business opportunity for you.
For sure, for culturally competent care specifically. Mm-hmm. And then his his comments about coming out. This is Pride Month, so I'm going to focus a little bit here on on this topic, you know. But his comments on the importance of coming out to providers and providers having that capability to ask questions that bring people a sense of comfort to come out are really important. And his mentioning the fact that, like, what does it mean to an anesthesiologist whether I come out or not? And he made it really real by saying, listen, I'm in pre-op holding and I'm thinking about, well, you're not driving home, even if I'm taking you under. So what is your family situation like, or what is your home situation like? Am I sending you home to a place that's safe? Do you have a ride? Do you have someone to take care of you, et cetera? Those are questions that will lead to the need for a patient to potentially come out, and his ability as an anesthesiologist to be comfortable. Now, it's easy for him as a, you know, a gay dad to have those conversations, but more broadly to physicians in general. I thought that was really interesting in his understanding and calling out that not being able to do that does the patients a disservice. A couple other nuggets that I wanted to...
Yeah, you got an extra large order here.
I know, I know. I like this. It was meaty. He mentioned early on in the conversation around 2 in 3 physicians experiencing some level of burnout during the pandemic, and based off of the latest survey. And I was like, well, that's interesting. What made me think is, like, how long have we been tracking physician burnout?
Right.
So I was looking this up on the AMA's website, and apparently it's been since about 2011. So this has been an ongoing survey series that's been done in conjunction with Mayo Clinic and others that I did some digging into. And what's interesting is that it actually took a dip during the pandemic and then back up at the at the end. So we found, or they found, I didn't find, I was not researching these things.
You're not part of the study team.
I definitely was not. But they found that in 2011, burnout was about 45.5% as compared to the 63% it was in this 2021 survey that he referenced. But in 2020, which really dug into parts of the actual pandemic, it was only at 38.2%. And I found that to be absolutely fascinating. So I encourage everybody to go look at this survey series and kind of track the ups and downs of physician burnout. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, I'm actually really intrigued by that, Elliot. I wonder, like, how many respondents they had during the pandemic years, right? Like, if fewer physicians actually filled out the survey because they were so exhausted, right?
Yeah, I mean, their N was, they surveyed, at least in this last one, they surveyed 43,300 physicians and, you know, received back, well, that's how many they asked. That's not how many respondents they had. They had about 2,400 respondents, which is still not bad. But
not bad.
It's only 5.6% of their total invites. But anyway, they attributed the reduction in burnout during that or the early stages of the pandemic to, you know, just like everybody else, suddenly not having to work, right? And in many areas, right? So I've got now more time to spend with my family, right? All those other things that affected everybody.
Sure, a lot of outpatient practices closed.
Exactly. Yeah. And
oh my gosh. Okay. Yeah, that's really
so awesome. It was fascinating. It was a fascinating study. Highly recommend people go look at it. Cool. Finally, the last thing I'll say is after we finished the conversation, Jesse sent me a blog that he had written celebrating 20 years of marriage. And as celebrating 20 years of marriage equality in America from the first time a state had legalized gay marriage back in 2004.
Here I am thinking it was like his 20th anniversary with his partner.
No.
I'm such a hopeless romantic.
But I thought it was really interesting. I mean, as you would expect from a guy that had like, what, 175 publications and like 20 books that he had written, it was chock full of data. And so he was quoting this RAND study that really did high quality quantitative analysis on the positivity of gay marriage in in America over the last 20 years, you know, showing things like an increase in insurance coverage and reduction in Medicaid coverage, or an increase in children on private insurance policies, reduction in ED visits among young people for STIs. And what I found to be really striking is the reduction in high school students attempting suicide because they see that their lives are normalized and accepted and part of the culture in which they live. And so this blog, we'll post a link to the blog post in addition to everything else, but that was, I thought, a really powerful little blog post celebrating marriage. So anyway, those are my nuggets. Yeah. Happy Pride.
Happy Pride.
Sarah, what nuggets did you nosh on during the conversation?
Well, Elliot, you coursed it. You had your four courses of nuggets. I am going to be doing tweezer nuggets. So, you know, like little tweezer food that they get at those super fancy restaurants. You pay like four times as much as you should and you leave and you're still
hungry. Well, what I'm hearing is I was quantity and you're quality. That's what I'm getting out of this conversation.
Oh my gosh, it's not quality. Trust me. I would much rather go to KFC and get a bucket of your nuggets than have tweezer nuggets. But my really poor analogy was essentially saying I just have two and they're pretty brief, but impactful. So my first nugget was that Jesse thinks that we're in the media business. I mean, OMG, I freaked out just a tiny bit when we were doing the interview. Total fangirl moment, like when the president of the AMA thinks that you're in the media business.
I know, right? And he said it so nonchalant.
Then you really are, right?
It was like, you guys are in the media business.
Yeah. That was amazing. Life goals achieved. Okay. And my second nuggets are both related. My second nuggets, that doesn't make sense grammatically, but you follow me. They're both related to health policy and some recent rules that have come out of the federal government, as well as statewide medical boards that are starting to crack down on AI in healthcare and really targeting physicians who use AI in clinical practice. So first and foremost, I agree with Jesse that we need to demand transparency in AI in healthcare. And I loved his example of let's learn from the aviation industry, that 737 MAX tragedy that he recapped for us. We don't want that to happen in healthcare, right? We do need some level of regulatory oversight. So he's not advocating for a complete vacuum or free market, if you will. Doctors need to know which algorithms are being implemented in their practices. They need education and training on how to use them as a complement to their clinical judgment, right? So I thought that was an excellent point that he made about transparency.
Yeah, and I like the fact that he distinguished that from explainability, which are two very different things when you're talking about AI, right? The explainability of the AI, the whole black box problem, is one thing, but then just the transparency of it, of knowing that it's actually being used at all, is something completely separate.
Yeah, I love it. Thank you for that, distinguishing those two, because I agree that they are different and important. And then there was this mention, I was learning for me, of two new rules that have come down from on high that impact physicians directly who use AI in their clinical practice. So the first one he mentioned was on April 26th of this year, the Department of Health and Human Services Office for Civil Rights and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services issued a new rule under Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act, and I quote, that advances protections against discrimination in healthcare. And if you read the rule, there are many, many good things in it, right? There are protections for LGBTQ folk, right? But it also sort of extends its reach to artificial intelligence and essentially renders physicians solely responsible or liable for any AI-related errors that result in patient harm. And then the second rule that he mentioned was actually a policy that was issued on May 2nd by the Federation of State Medical Boards, which licenses physicians. And I'm going to quote directly from that policy. State medical boards do not regulate tools or technologies only licensed physicians that use those tools. Consistent with the prevailing standards for any tool used in the delivery of healthcare, the physician is ultimately responsible for the use of AI and should be held accountable for any harms that occur. So, holy moly, right?
Yeah, geez, wow.
You know, and what does this really mean? If it means that healthcare systems are going to have to invest a significant amount of capital in educating their physicians about artificial intelligence. Or, as Jesse mentioned, we risk going into an AI winter, and we simply cannot afford for that to happen because there are not enough doctors and there are not enough nurses, and we need technology to step up and step in and support. And to quote you, Elliot, we need machines that make healthcare more human for our patients. So I think our show notes are going to be like biblical in length this time, but I will link to both of that, those rules in the show notes. For those of you that want to open up a nice Pinot by the fire this weekend and read through them yourselves. And with that, I invite our listeners to follow us on LinkedIn, leave us a review wherever you pod. That really helps our algorithms. Make sure you tell a friend, tell a frenemy, tell an enemy, just tell someone that you love or don't love, Second to the Limit. Next month, we are super excited. I personally am very excited to welcome my good friend, Dr. Anjali Bagra, to the show. She's an internal medicine physician at Mayo Clinic, a resiliency expert. She also happens to be our medical director of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And her most recent feather in her very large cap is she is the newly named medical director of automation at Mayo Clinic. So she's going to be talking to us about sort of the confluence of all of her different levels of expertise and how we can leverage automation to drive human-centered transformation in the industry. So super stoked to have Anjali on the show next month. Elliot, would you like to send us off with a health tech haiku?
There is nothing that I would like to do more. This health tech haiku send-off is in honor of our guest this month. So here we go. Healing hearts and minds. Combat vet to health tech's helm. Equity in care. Lovely. Lovely.
Very nice. I love the subtle references to Star Trek, too. I mean, it just, you know, kind of bubbles up to it the does. Surface.
Well, thanks to Jesse Ehrenfeld for joining us this month. Thank you, everybody. And we will see you next time.
See you next time.
See you next time.
Never gets old.
Tech It to the Limit is produced by Sarah Harper
and Elliot Wilson in consultation with ChatGPT.
Because they are masochists and also don't have any sponsors.
Yet. Music was composed by the world-famous court minstrel Evan O'Donovan.
To consume more hilarious and informative content about digital transformation in healthcare, visit us online at techittothelimit.fun.
And don't forget to follow us on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, and across the event horizon. See you next time on
Tech It to the Limit.